Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And we have a great show for you this evening. We also have a special guest coming on the second hour. I'm going to hold that secret right now. The only bad thing I can think about tonight is I just found out just now that Alejandro is not going to be joining us for the UFO updates. He's in a state of moving and all different types of things. So at the last minute, he said he could not make it. So it's like the dog ate my homework. I have no stories prepared to talk about, really, in the UFO world. I know there's a lot going on. I think I saw where some professor is saying that, I'm not sure exactly who he is, but he's saying that he really does believe that we're going to find out very soon that there is life on Mars. Oh, it's a NASA chief scientist. Here's a headline here. It says, we're close to finding and announcing alien life on Mars, but is the world ready? What a nice title that is for getting a lot of clickbait out there. That's actually on the Telegraph in the UK. So anyway, we'll see how that holds out. I remember about 5 years ago, I was saying something along the lines that I thought we would find signs of alien life on Mars within a year. Well, I got that wrong. I'm glad I didn't take any bets on that. So I want to talk a little bit. First of all, I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. I want to thank the good people over at KGRA Radio, also over the Dark Matter Digital Network, who's been running my show consistently for several years now. And I want to thank the people that help out behind the scenes here. There's a few of them. And Peggy, she helps out with the Facebook page. She puts up UFO and related stories almost every single day of the year on the Facebook page, and that's under Podcast UFO. Anyone can jump over there, and anyone can support the show. We have a Patreon site. We also have a subscription service where people can listen to the full shows. The first 55 minutes or so are free to anyone for listening to. I do appreciate every single listener. And if you really want to listen to the whole show, but you can't, we do live stream over at YouTube. And after that, the show stays up on YouTube. As long as YouTube will be around and my account is still around, it'll be there. And I think I have something like 300 audio shows over at YouTube. But it's always best if you can listen in your media player. And that's why it's kind of popular for people that want to help out. They get to use their media player. It kind of pops in. The full shows will pop in. The free shows will pop in, too. It's a free show on your media player if you just sign up, subscribe to it. But anyway, so for $2 or more a month, you can help out with the show and get that full show and all the archives. Also, there's another way you can do that as far as the full shows. Oh, yes, of course, you can listen live always on Tuesday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. That's Eastern Time. And it's also at KGRA Radio. It's on our website as well. We do have a blog this week, another great blog. Actually, it's one of my favorite blogs written in quite a while. And that's by Charles Lear, who writes blogs for us, and it's called Just the UFO Facts. And basically what he's talking about, there was a really, really great UFO researcher several years ago. Unfortunately, he died very young, at about 38 years old with leukemia. But his name was Kenny Young, and I think he was in the Ohio area. So he kind of writes a story about that. Also, it gets into Jackie Gleason, the old-time comedian. When I was a little kid, I remember watching the Jackie Gleason show, so that kind of dates me as far as how old I am. But I love that show. But Jackie Gleason had a real interest in UFOs and supposedly has a story about Nixon taking him to see alien bodies. Now, I don't know about that. I think that's that can be a little bit out there, but still, it's a great story. And Kenny Young did some work on that. And so that's all in our blog. Check that out. And we have a blog we've been getting them about every week or so. A little bit about our guests. Kevin Day, he's a return guest. He's been on this show. Actually, he was on my show and quite a while ago. I'm trying to remember exactly when. Now, Kevin actually contacted, it all started way back when Robert Powell was on my show. And Kevin I think he posted something on YouTube. And so it started a conversation with Robert Powell and Kevin Day. And Kevin Day has come a long way since then. He has really been getting involved in this. I really do appreciate it. I got to meet him out in Phoenix at the UFO, International UFO Congress. Great guy. A great speaker, actually. It was really interesting. And what I really appreciate the most about Kevin and actually working with him, I work behind the scenes there, and is Kevin speaks from the heart. And there's no BS when it comes to the things he talks about. And, you know, this has taken an effect on him, this whole Nimitz case. And he has actually come a long way since that time. He's involved in a number of things. And he was the guy when it comes to the intercept controller. He's a Top Gun air intercept controller, and he was on the Princeton. I may be saying some of this wrong, but he was on the USS Princeton during the Tic Tac incident and was wondering what the heck was going on. Then our second guest, Gary Voorhis, his background is mechanical engineering and working with electronic and RF technician, and he had some involvement in this as well. At his time on the USS Princeton, he had the task of security and inventory of top secret and classified information and materials, including being trained on the WASP military recon UAV for the Pacific Fleet during and enduring the Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom. Anyway, on the week of the 14th of November in 2004, he was an eyewitness of the USS Nimitz Tic Tac events. And so I'm really excited to have both of these guests on, and I want to welcome them now to the show. Welcome to the show, guys.
Great to be here, Martin. This is Kevin Day.
I'm glad you identified yourself.
Yeah. This is Gary. Thanks for having us.
Gary, it's the first time, glad to meet you. Thank you for being on. Gary, since you have not been on before, can you kind of give your background basically on the situation and your involvement with the incident? But first of all, your background and how things unfolded, if you would.
My background is Aegis computer technician aboard the ship. I ran all the mainframes, ran Spy-1 Bravos, all the consoles and CIC. I controlled all the data recording for the Aegis system and the CEC systems. What hasn't really come up, I don't know why it hasn't come up, but the Q-70 system that we had aboard was a hybrid version for the 6.1 baseline for the Aegis. It's when we went from the older Aegis system to the new caught off the shelf stuff. It's when we kind of moved into Unix and fiber optics.
Wow. Now what did fiber optics change in what you do?
Mostly just the relays on the ship, how fast everything came back and forth through everything, and our video, how detailed the information comes in through.
I see. And Kevin, would you be actually working with Gary at all? I mean, did you two know each other actually?
Yeah, we knew each other. You know, it's a pretty small ship. What was it, Gary? About 350 people or so when we actually go on deployment. Now, I was an operator, Martin, so I was not a technician. And Gary was a technician, and so he's was up in Combat Information Center up in CIC quite often. Yeah, and he was a third class petty officer at the time. I was a senior chief, so I mean, you know, our association was a little limited, right, Gary? I mean,
yeah, we would chat here and there. He wasn't directly in my chain of command, so it was a little bit more casual than normal chief to junior. But, you know, he's always – I tell you what, this guy was a stickler, by-the-book guy when I first met him.
And I still am. Arrgh.
Interesting. So, Kevin, can you please give out your background, basically? And I know you were on the show before, but and it may be redundant to some people, but there are a lot of new listeners, so if you wouldn't mind.
You bet. I joined the Navy in 86, went to boot camp, and did really well in my A school for operations specialists, and I was able to choose my orders out of – I got the first pick of orders out of three classes, which was kind of cool. And, of course, I picked the latest and greatest ship that they had. It was the USS Vincennes. It was the first Aegis cruiser on the West Coast. And that ended up being my first ship. Made my first few deployments on that ship. Decided to stay in the Navy. I'm glad I did. And I basically ended up on three Aegis cruisers, the Chosin, the Princeton, and the Vincennes. And I've done staff duty. I was on the staff on the Constellation. And for the Admiral's training staff in North Island as well. And when the incident happened in 2004, I had probably 18 years of actual radar background and experience on the Spiral 1 radar. And I'd been in about 20 years, but I'd done some instructor duty too, that took me off the ships. And so, you know, I was a pretty well experienced guy on that radar when I started observing these objects, and they were pretty enormous. At first, I was just really scratching my head what the hell these things were.
I bet. And Gary, had you known anything about the objects in the beginning, or did it just take a while to trickle to you? Gary, there?
Yeah, sorry. I was trying to unmute myself. We were probably the first ones that knew it. The spy radar guys were really, because we honestly didn't even think they were real tracks. We really weren't paying much attention to them. We thought they were ghost tracks and just kind of clutter, and the system just kind of needs to be recalibrated.
Oh, so you kept thinking it needed recalibration?
Yeah, we actually did. And then we got permission from the captain to tape the system down, and we did a full from top to bottom on it, and then brought it back up, and lo and behold, those tracks are still there as clear as day.
Wow. Gary, may I ask you something? Are you glowing? I see your headset is glowing.
It sure is. I'm a gamer, so I've got a gaming headset.
Oh, is that what that's about? Yeah.
Yeah, there's.
And what is the purpose for glowing in a game?
it looks cool.
Oh, I got it. Okay, very good. So what happened when you went to recalibrate, and what exactly did that do?
All right, so what it did is it cleared up any clutter there actually was, and actually sharpened the tracks. And when I say sharpen, it means that the tracks came through even more clear and more defined. They were most definitely solid object tracks.
Hmm. And did you alert anyone of this, or is your deal just to deal with that alone and not alert anyone in particular? I mean, in this situation, were there other people saying, hey, you know, what's going on beside you?
Yeah, there was plenty of people, and that's really the watchstander's duty to do that. They report to us that they see, you know, ghost tracks, or they're seeing the OSs will tell us something's wrong, and then we'll fix it. Most of the time, if you see an OS with a wrench or a screwdriver, you usually tackle them and wrench it away from them because they're not allowed to touch anything.
Wow. And Gary, you had to handle the classified information. Does that mean this is a layman terms, like radar tapes? Is that something you'd also handle?
It would be all the tracking information from the spy. It'd be all of the data coming, because we also have a system that keeps track of the Aegis system called ORTS. And ORTS keeps track of – it's got data points throughout the entire Aegis system. It tells us everything about the system and how it's running. And so all that information would be in there. CC, whether it's off or on, any peripherals that are attached to the Aegis system, the status of all the actual computers, whether they're up, down, how well they're operating, all that stuff gets recorded on data tapes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I hate to do this to some of the listening audience that knows this Nimitz case really, really well. But like I mentioned a few minutes ago, we have tons of new listeners to the show all the time. And a lot of people are just plain getting into the UFO topic because of, you know, some of the credible stories, including, I want to say, probably leading the pack is the Nimitz case. So if you don't mind, would one of you want to take the handle and just kind of doing a nutshell of what exactly happened back in November of 2004?
You bet,
go ahead.
You bet, Martin. Yeah. This is Kevin.
Yep.
2004, that was quite a while ago now, and it was just a few years into, you know, the war had started, and things were pretty hot and heavy. We received orders to deploy a little bit early, and so we were off the coast of San Diego. The Nimitz, it was us, and we had the air wing on board. Now, the USS Chaffee and the USS Higgins also played, but they weren't there physically with us. They were hooked up remotely over basically a gaming network that allows us to play with them. And it was on, I think it was like on the 10th of November, I went up to combat, or I was already on watch, and I noticed there was probably six tracks at that time, right off the coast of Catalina Island, which was north of about 90 miles or so. And the reason why I said they were weird is because they were at 28,000 feet in a kind of a tight group of a formation, and they were tracking to the south at 100 knots, which was really bizarre because usually things that high don't fly that slow.
Right. Or can't fly. That
slow. I wasn't really concerned about them because they're way up there. We're way down here. It's off the coast of California. And heck, it could have been just something civilian related. They didn't even know we were there. It had nothing at all to do with this. But of course, we tried to ID them. There's a certain process and protocols we use for ID and everything, and everybody in combat kind of puts in their own piece of the puzzle. And an actual human makes the identification. You know, our systems aren't automatic, they're automated, and it gives us all the pieces of information. And then I was the guy that made the call. I was the guy that that actually identified stuff. It was the position in combat is called the Anti-Air Warfare Coordinator, or AWIC. And all attempts to ID these things failed us. It was really bizarre. It was humbling, actually. There was years and years and years of combined experience in that room, and none of us had any idea what these things were. And like Gary said, in fact, we thought they were some kind of glitch, some kind of problem in the computer or whatever. So they brought everything down, brought everything back up, and lo and behold, they were still there. And they tracked down to the south and eventually faded off radar right around the vicinity of Guadalupe Island, which is off the coast of Baja California. And then it would be, a few hours or maybe the next day, I'd go up to combat radar and watch. And there would be another group of these things in the same spot doing the same damn thing. And it just...
Yeah, we spent about 2 weeks smoking a lot of cigarettes and looking for bearings and trying to find lights in the sky.
Yeah, people up on the bridge trying to find these things on the big eye binoculars. And, you know, if it hadn't have been for the fact we were going to do an air defense exercise on the 14th of November, there's probably a pretty good chance we would have never decided to intercept these things. Because like I said, they didn't constitute any sort of threat. No threat profiles, no hostile intentions or anything. And the only reason why I recommended to Captain Smith that we actually do an intercept is because on the 14th, we were going to launch a bunch of aircraft. We were going to do a mock air battle, which launch aircraft off the coast of California and come out there and attack us in a mock air, air defense exercise. And at that point, I became concerned because now these objects are in the same piece of sky as with our friendly aircraft, and there was a real good high potential for some sort of air-to-air mishap because we didn't know what these were.
Sure.
And based on that concern, Captain Smith directed me to consummate an intercept, which we did. I'm a Top Gun Air Intercept Control Supervisor, so the actual AIC, who has not come out publicly, was actually doing the control, and I was standing behind him on a parrot on a headset with a long cord and helping him coordinate external radio comms communications and helping him interpret the radar. So he picked the closest contact, and Commander Fravor happened to have been airborne. He had just launched. And so we vectored him in that direction, and we had the communications up in the overhead speaker. And as soon as he got to the merge plot position, which is basically two aerial objects in the same piece of vertical sky.
Right.
So that when you look at them on a two-dimensional display, it looks like one object now. As soon as he got to that merge plot position, we hear on the radio, "Oh my God, oh my God, I'm engaged, I'm engaged." And there was just stunned silence on the ship. That wasn't wow. supposed to happen. And that contact that he intercepted
now, suddenly when you say dropped you're- from... I'm sorry, when someone says they're engaged, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean just visual?
That just means they're in the same visual piece. They're visual now with each other, and they're turning around each other. It doesn't mean they're firing guns or anything at each other.
But they're actually
it's kind of a bad.
So they're doing like this dance. They're, you know, connected in that way.
Or a dogfight, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when he got to that merge plot position, that contact that we vectored him to suddenly dropped from 28,000 feet all the way down to the surface of the ocean. And we found out the next day it was 0.78 seconds.
0.78 seconds. So under 1 second.
Yeah, 0.78.
Yeah, this thing would consistently move at speeds that would just blow your mind.
Yeah, what did a scientific correlation for ufology come up with, Gary? Do you remember the number? Like, was it 1,350 Gs or something like that?
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
We can ask Robert. Just, yeah, we'll ask Robert when he comes on. Yeah, and, you know, heck, the human body can't withstand that. You know, hell no. We can and still remain without any type of protection or anything, maybe 8 Gs. The aircraft itself can withstand maybe 14 before it starts to come apart.
Of course. Well, I mean, and if they're using a, you know, gravitational system, you know, honestly, the G's aren't even going to be a thing. So,
and what do you mean by that exactly? What are you talking about, Gary?
If they're if they're manipulating gravity and they're doing where, you know, they're not actually moving with inertia, there would be no inertia at all. So they're not even going to feel it inside.
Can you explain that a little
bit? Non-Newtonian.
Yeah.
It was non-classical physics. That's what Gary's talking about now. We're all pretty convinced this had to have been some quantum.
It's like there's the popular theory right now is that basically it moves through space-time, moving and making a bubble in front of it of stretching space-time in front of it so that it moves through space-time rather than actual physical, you know, anything. So it's like just sitting in this bubble that's not being affected by gravity or anything else. It's just being moved through by its own propulsion, manipulating, using anti-gravity.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, we are at break time, so we are going to head into the break. So everyone hang in there. We'll be right back right after these messages. See, Kevin, you're out on the West Coast, right?
That's right. I live in Southern Oregon.
Southern Oregon. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful area.
It's very beautiful, yes.
Now, I just figure we'll pick up where we left off when we come back from break. But are you, now that you're out there, you've been out there for how many years now?
Out in Oregon?
Yeah.
I was raised here. Back in my hometown.
All right. Had you ever had any interest in UFOs or ever even paid attention to the subject prior to this?
I've been listening to Coast AM since mid to late 90s.
Oh.
So, yeah, I've had an interest in it. I was never a researcher or anything like that, but I had a passing interest in UFOs, sure.
Uh-huh. And what about you, Gary?
I watched X-Files, and honestly, most of my interest is just how the tech works.
Oh, really? That's your interest. Isn't that something? So, yeah, I want to know a little bit more about, I think that's really interesting what you're saying about this gravity, however you call that exactly. Because I think there's a guy named, he's been on the show before. His name is slipping my mind right now. Robert is his first name. He has this theory about this gravity type of movement that he thinks is propulsion, which I think is pretty interesting. And basically things are like falling or something. It's never, I may be confusing him with someone else. Actually, I think he does have more like space time folded or something like that.
That's actually a little bit different of a theory. I mean, basically, they all go into quantum physics, and one of the thoughts that I'm going into is basically there's a newer thought about quantum entanglement, how like everything is connected at some point in every mm-hmm. point of the universe, and so that using that, you can technically open up a black hole, a stable wormhole, the whole Einstein-Rosenberg bridge type thing, and just basically move from point to point at any speed anywhere you want. Well, it's not restricted to distance, so you can do mm-hmm. it in small jumps, you can do it in big jumps. So I've been just kind of toying with the numbers to see if any of that even comes close. And I'm actually, because when I went through school for physics in college, none of this was like some wackadoo's theory, and then it wasn't like validated until like within the last 10 years, and it's been a long time since I was in school.
Wow. So, Ray, so we have to go back?
Not yet. We've got 30 seconds before the bumper rolls.
30 seconds. So total about 45 seconds?
You got it.
Okay. All right. No, it's all interesting, and we can talk a little bit about the physics, because that part of it I find fascinating. I have Seth Shostak from SETI coming up in a couple of weeks, and I've mentioned to him prior when he was on years ago, maybe we just haven't figured something out in physics, because the main argument is how the heck did they get here, from there. I think we're about ready, aren't we, Race? All right, everyone, welcome back. I want to welcome back my guests, that is. And we have Kevin Day and Gary Voorhis, and we're talking about the USS Nimitz case. And right off the coast of San Diego, happened back in November 2004. A lot of time has gone by. And speaking of that, either one of you can take this up. Our memory gets all twisted and faded, and things get jumbled around. Either one of you take the time at the time and, make notations for yourself? I know, Kevin, you wrote a book, kind of a fiction book, after kind of working this out in your head. But, Gary, how about you? Did you make notes or anything of what you saw, witnessed?
Mental notes, mostly about angles of descent and speeds, things like that, and, the way that it maneuvered.
And Gary, did you actually physically see one of the objects?
I saw it on a number of occasions. But when I say I saw it, it was through a very heavily magnified set of binoculars that are mounted to the bridge wing of the ship called Big Eyes.
Oh, yes. I know what those are. Yeah.
During the day, we're talking, it's like a dot in the horizon. So you're seeing it in the you look at the bearing and you're just looking for something moving in that area. At night, you could see it a lot better. Because at least it was a glowing dot, but,
I'm not really sure if I'm aware of the fact that they actually glowed.
Well, it's kind of like a whitish light that you'd see on the horizon.
Interesting. And, were you at this point, were you, and your shipmates basically taking turns in the binoculars, like checking these things out? Or?
Well, the bridge wing really wasn't a spot where people could just walk out to in bulk or numbers. So you basically had to make sure that, it wasn't going to cause a problem, because you still had all the operations of the ship being steered and everything right there to the right of you inside the bridge. So if the officer of the deck at the time didn't want you out there, you couldn't go out there, and they would definitely not let a whole crowd of people out there.
Yeah. Now, did any, to your knowledge, did any of the officers have a curiosity to look for themselves?
I'll be honest with you. I really don't know, because I would just, I would try to hit it when there was nobody there.
I got it. Yeah. One of the things that has puzzled me about this whole thing is, okay, so David Fravor, and I think there was There was another case where someone else went out and, you know, had, I don't want to say a dogfight, but they actually witnessed it an hour later or something. Am I right on that? They flew out again, and there was another encounter?
Well, I know the actual video encounter was actually the second set of planes that went out for intercepts. It wasn't actually Fravor that took the video.
Right. Yeah. So the thing that's always been really curious to me is, okay, they saw this unbelievable thing, this unbelievable technology. Where's the curiosity? I mean, to me, I would think that, you know, the government would want to just be out there studying this thing, you know, from that moment on. And, you know, is, things just do not work that way, or, you know, what's the deal with that?
Well, just for the kind of the casual, relaxed way that the chain of command dealt with it, you know, that actually kind of lends to my thought process that, you know, somebody somewhere knew already.
They knew already that these things were happening, or that these things have been there many times?
Well, I've got a working theory that I think it's our own reverse engineered tech, and that just the sloppy way that they were. Because, I mean, when you hear about a lot of UFOs, you know, it's like they're here, they're gone. They got a purpose. They come down, they do something, and then they leave. Where here, these things were just basically just kind of like, hey, we're here. Why don't you take a look at us? And then when we intercept them, then they decide they're going to, you know, move around and you know, so I think it might have been some type of proof of concept of some type of our own tech.
Really? That's your working theory on that. That's pretty amazing. I will tell you this. I'm in the, basically the fine arts and antique business. And I was at a client's house, just a couple of days ago, and I'm going to have to paraphrase this because I don't remember exactly what he said. But he did work with the Navy, and he had something to do with flight. I think he said flight control or something like that along those lines. I can't remember exactly what it was. But when I spoke with him, I asked him if he had heard anything about the USS Nimitz case and all that. And he said, yeah, he said, I heard about it. And then he went on to say things like, you know, it's interesting. But he said when he was out in California, he was near some, you know, place where they were developing, you know, high tech things possibly. And he used to see things show up and disappear and show up and disappear. And he just assumed that it was our technology, which, you know, I had never really heard anyone talk about it until you just, you know, you're mentioning it now. But, you know, I have to say that, you know, I would think that what they were doing is, if we could actually do that, it just seems like that would be so far ahead of what I would imagine we would have for technology. But if you think it's possible, you know, it's just something we have to think of as a possibility.
Like I said, you know, a lot of these working theories that I have are just based off of what could be true. If, you know, if it's true that we, you know, recovered a craft in Roswell, well, there's a good chance that we've reverse engineered a good chunk of that, or at least been able to use that tech, even if we couldn't reverse engineer it.
But okay, though, hey, here's a question about that theory then, is they knew, I mean, one branch of the whatever it is would speak to the other as far as like doing your, you know, your exercises out there and see, wouldn't they not be in the area at that time? I mean, it just seems like one branch of the government would know that.
Well, it depends on the program. I mean, how long did ATIP run before anybody even knew that word ATIP?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's really just all these programs would just be, you know, they'd be secret, so you wouldn't know. So if they decide they want to go out, test it against the best we got right now, do proof of concept, they know where we're at, they know we're not going to have a weapons loadout, they know that they're not in any way going to be able to damage the vehicles. So they go out, do proof of concept, come back, say, and then, you know, high five each other because they were out be able to outdog us.
Wow.
Yeah, and Robert, I'll chime in here. I'll be honest. I don't know what those objects were, but I know what they weren't, because that was my job. My entire job was to identify things that flew in the air. And believe me, we tried to identify them. To this day, I don't know what they were. I have concerns if this was our stuff, because we were out there doing an exercise, and for us not to know there was another exercise layered on top of us. It's not only dangerous, it could also be potentially even illegal. But I have an open mind. I really do. I have an open mind about what these are.
Because the U.S. military has never done anything dangerous or illegal.
No, they don't do those things.
Well, it's really an interesting theory. The one thing, I have to say, Gary, pardon me, is if they did not have this gravity technology that you're speaking of, it would just be impossible for any type of craft to, be able to handle that type of 1300, did you say, G-forced?
Well, the craft, it would definitely stress it would be at the very edge of its capabilities, as, metal fatigue, things like that. And they definitely, if they didn't have any type of gravitational propulsion systems, they would have 100% been nothing alive inside those things. They would have had to have been drones at that point.
Yeah. And so, but this, if it was a drone, it seemed to engage, the craft, Fravor's craft, pretty accurately. I guess that would be remote, but it just doesn't seem to make sense that, first of all, it could drop the 28,000 feet in, a fraction of a second and still have, remote capabilities. I mean, this is all just, you wouldn't have remote technology for that in reverse engineered, spacecraft, I don't think.
Well, I mean, we are talking about some pretty seriously advanced technology at this point. Who knows what the range on a remote device would be for something like that?
Yeah, Kevin, there was, how many would you say that you saw in any given situation at one time?
They appeared on the radar in groups of 5 to 10 at a time, and if I was to add up all the groups over the entire period of time we were tracking these things, there was probably about 100 total objects. Now, I don't have any idea if they were 100 separate objects or they were the same five, groups, the same groups basically repeating somehow. I don't even know if they're all the same shape and size, because all I'm looking at on my console is a symbol. Symbology represents everything. Uh-huh. So it's based on my loose math of about 100 altogether.
So, going back to, Gary's thoughts or whatever, it just seems like if there was this tic-tac-shaped objects that was developed by the military and they were testing them, you would seem to kind of get the idea that a lot of people would be seeing them. It wouldn't just be your situation. They'd be seeing them over and over and over. And are there any other, people that have come forward saying they're seeing the same objects that you're aware of?
I know Kevin has done some research in this, especially with the sightings around the same area that we were at. And apparently there's been hundreds of people that have seen it.
So,
yeah. And then the more recent events on the East Coast with the Roosevelt battle group, according to some of the reports I've heard from those guys, is they were seeing them, some sort of objects out there on almost on a daily basis for a period of time.
But that's more like
that's where the gimbal and the go fast videos came
from.
Yeah,
I was going to say, but that's, the gimbal is not, you're not your tic tac shape, and then you're going to be getting into some other type of technology that is, if it's our own,
They could have different models using the same thing. I mean, they could be for different things, because, RF-18s don't look like jumbo jets. It's just a matter of where they could have different purposes. One could be reconnaissance. One could be, for use for actual combat.
All right. Along those lines, Gary, when the craft went right down and it was hovering over a disturbance in the water, Why would you, you know, just in your, along your lines of your theory, no one really knows what that was about either, but it wouldn't seem like it would make any sense that if it's a drone, that it would be checking out a disturbance in the water. I don't know.
Just I mean, the only thing I could really, I mean, just you got to remember, all this is theories based off of no actual knowledge, just me trying to piece things together that make sense to me. And if the thing that was under the water has never been identified, we don't know what it was, and it could have been the controller. It could have been a mothership. It could have been a much larger ship that launched these things. Mm-hmm. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. So I have your kind of your theory. That's your top theory, but you're open to other possibilities, I imagine.
I'm open up to any possibility. If anybody wants to lay something out, and you know, I'll follow down any path anybody wants, and talk with them about it.
Now, Gary, just one thing. Also, do you think the government or would have that has knowledge of this that they could just keep this thing quiet if they did have something like this, or do you think it would have to be in the private sector?
I think a little bit of both. I think that the government knows a lot more about it than we could ever even possibly know. And they also are not stupid enough to think that they're going to be able to keep it under wraps forever.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that a lot of the tech, if it is being reverse engineered, has probably been released to some of these bigger companies like, you know, Apple and Microsoft and, you know, or any of these, and pushing it out on the market.
All right. So along your theory as well, then if this is the case, then why would the Navy change their stance on the UFO status of people reporting in the Navy, pilots are reporting unidentified objects? Why would they change the status if it's our technology?
I would think they would change the status for the simple fact that with literally everybody having a 4K camera in their pockets now, eventually people are going to get good video. People are going to find real evidence on, you know, all these things that are going on. And it, I mean, and it could be a little bit of everything that everybody wanted. Usually the truth is stranger than reality. So I'm really looking forward to seeing where all this goes.
Yeah, I am too. It's kind of like we're in exciting times, and we're going to be talking a little bit about that, Kevin, because I know you're involved. I don't know, I'm sure if you're involved with him at all, and some things coming up. But Kevin, what are your thoughts similar to Gary's, or do you have your own idea of what you may have been witnessing?
I don't know what they were, Martin. And
that's probably a really good answer.
Yeah, it's completely honest. I just really hate to speculate about it, because, you know, if I go out on the radio here and I say, yeah, those are definitely aliens.
Yeah.
Well, then by God, I got to be able to defend that. And I just can't. I don't have the evidence.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say something like that. So the best answer for me is I don't know.
I got it. So, Kevin, what you're involved in a couple of things. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. I'm kind of picking back up on the story. The kind of the scene setter here, Commander Fravor followed the object down to the surface because he saw the disturbance. And in fact, he thought it was a downed aircraft at first, and it turned out it wasn't, thank God. But this object, when he went down there, it kind of turned on him a little bit, was aware of him, reacted to him. And all of a sudden that object went straight back up to 28,000 feet. And again, 0.78 seconds, continued tracking towards the south, towards Baja California, as if nothing fun had just happened.
Wow.
You asked earlier if we had taken notes and stuff, and I in fact did. And one of the notes that I did take is I wrote down the latitude and the longitude of where all of these objects faded from my radar. And it turns out they're co-located with Guadalupe Island off the coast of Baja. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if they descended there or my radar just couldn't track them anymore because it was too far away. But I'll tell you what, when Lou Elizondo and Tom DeLong came to my house to interview me, when I mentioned the fact that I had the latitude and longitude, I didn't even get the word out of my mouth. And I'll never forget this. He's like, we're going there. I'm going to get a boat and we're going out there. And that's what they did. That's with Sean Cahill.
Wow.
When they went out to Guadalupe. It was based on that information I was able to retained from my notes. So anyway, there's a bunch of other aircraft launching off the Nimitz. And before, there was one point in time when we literally had UFOs raining out of the sky, because these things just started dropping out of the sky in reaction to the aircraft. And they were all, in less than a second, went down to the surface, and they would pop straight back out 28,000 feet, I guess, when they felt it was safe to do it. And they continued tracking south at 100 knots.
That whole, the way they reacted. And
They acted like a flock of birds. If you throw a pebble into a flock of birds, they're going to scatter, but then they're going to regroup and continue on their way.
Almost organic-like.
Very organic behavior. And it was prescient. It was I had this overwhelming impression that thing, whatever they were somehow alive.
Yeah.
But that is just my own personal feeling, and totally based on how they were behaving.
Right. Almost like birds in a way. Now,
go ahead.
There's the other real curious thing about this whole situation is what's the point where they actually showed up? The point of where you were doing your exercise? Yeah. What's that called?
There is that one point in Commander Fravor's intercept where the object left his the location of where he was at in the sky, and it went about 60 miles away. And again, less than a second. And it went exactly to this spot in the sky that we call a combat air patrol station. And basically, real simply, what that is, if you got a strike group down to the south and you got a notional threat up to the north, we're going to have several points that we pick in the sky. And that's kind of just a point in the sky where the air crews kind of hang out until they get an order to do something. Now, there is no way that this object should have known where that cap point was.
And that's like right on it.
Yeah, right exactly on it.
Now, the whole point of what we're going to be out there for, like what you just asked, is that we were doing combat training.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole event prior to this whole intercept, real world intercept, we were all doing combat training.
And for it to show up there, that doesn't make
kind of continuing on the story a little bit, because it kind of alludes to something else that you asked me. When Commander Fravor landed back on the Nimitz, he pulled the flight crew that was getting ready to launch, and he said, "Hey, you guys, make sure you have an AT-FLIR pod loaded, the advanced forward lip looking infrared radar, because it can record video, and that's the video that we all see, the Tic Tac video." And I wasn't there, of course, but it's been reported through other people that Chad Underwood, who was a pilot, saying he's recently came out public. He said, "I'm going to go find those things." And you know what? That's exactly what he did.
Wow.
And it's based on that fact that we're actually going to go back out there and find them again, Martin.
Well, I hope
we're putting together, we're putting together an expedition. We're going to charter a research vessel. And I've got this thing crewed up with some pretty top-notch physicists, research scientists, trained observers. We've got a film crew that's going out with us, and we're taking a bunch of new technologies out there with us, because we want to create a situation where we are going to be able to provide incontrovertible evidence that, yes, UAP is real, yes, UAP is findable, and yes, UAP is knowable. Because if we're able to capture the data, we're going to capture the data in all different kinds of modalities to support us eyewitnesses on the ship. And we had originally planned to do it in November 2020, but I found out recently the research vessel isn't available till December. So we're pushing it. We're going to push it back. We're going to push it to the left and go out there in December 2020. Spend about 10 days. We're going to anchor off. There's a little cove off the southern tip of San Clemente Island, which is about midway between the SoCal operating areas and Catalina Island to the north.
Wow.
Where we can just anchor. We're just going to anchor there so we don't burn a lot of fuel.
So you're saying this is going to be a year from this December.
A year from this December, correct.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And it's all based on the fact that if we found them once, we can do it again. If we found them on radar once, we can do it again. using other technologies. We won't have radar. And if Chad Underwood vocalized the fact I'm going to go find him, then that's what I'm doing now.
Yeah, I think
conscious intent plays a big role in this. I really do.
In that one local area that we were at, like I said, there's been hundreds of sightings of UFOs, UAPs, underwater phenomenon, all kinds of stuff over there.
So yeah, you're talking near Catalina Island, right?
Yeah.
Because, that's pretty famous for that. We're going into break in just about 1 minute. We're going to be back with another guest I'll be talking about. But I do have an announcement. I'm pretty excited because I just got an email confirmation that the one and only Jacques Vallée will be on next week on this show. So I'm pretty happy about that. So we have just about a minute and or a little bit less than that. We'll be going to break. I do want to say that we're going to be coming back with Robert Powell. He's going to be joining the three of us. I think you kind of did the spoiler there. Kevin, you kind of said we can talk about that with Robert later. I don't know if anyone caught that or not, but that's okay. But anyway, hang in, everyone. We'll be right back. We're going to go on a hard break over at YouTube, and we'll be right back right after these messages. All right, everyone, welcome back. This is Martin Willis, and my guest this evening is Kevin Day and Gary Forrest, witnesses to the USS Nimitz tic-tac-toe. Did you hear me say that? Tic-tac UFO incident back in 2004. We have an additional guest. I'm really excited to say that Robert Powell has joined us. Robert, thank you, and welcome to the show.
Oh, it's good to see you again, Martin. I think it's been a year or so since I last was on your show.
Yeah, it wasn't really that long ago, but I was talking at the very beginning of the show how Kevin actually wrote a post on the YouTube that you and I did together, and you connected that way initially.
Yeah, actually, that's how I first found Kevin. I'm trying to remember if we did your show right before the New York Times article.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
It was
because
just
I started working on it in late 2016. And then I did your show. And then I saw a little note from Kevin where I don't even remember what he wrote. But I could tell from the way he wrote it was, okay, this is someone I should try to reach. So I sent him a email or a text or something like that
on Facebook, you told me.
I think so, yeah. And Kevin got back with me, and I interviewed Kevin in January of 2018, probably about 3 or 4 weeks after the New York Times story broke. And then Kevin's story was so amazing that I wanted to get some confirmation, so I went on to Facebook and I looked up the USS Princeton, and I got onto their site. They let me on, whoever the administrator is, and that's how I found Gary. I just started reading through the site, and I contacted everyone who on that site had indicated they had knowledge of the event.
And really?
Yeah, because I wanted someone to confirm what Kevin had told me, because it was pretty amazing.
And that's actually the only reason I ever came out to begin with, is just in support of Kevin.
Really?
Thank you, Gary.
So Gary, while you're on right now, if this had not happened, would this just be something you would have just taken to your grave, basically, and not talked about publicly?
Well, I probably would have still talked about it when I drank, and I don't really drink that often, so.
Yeah, and had you talked to family members and friends about this quietly?
Some people, but not a lot of people even want to know about this stuff. So,
and how about now?
Well, I don't even get recognized, so no, I don't really talk to too many people.
Yeah, yeah. But How about you were on Unidentified. Chris Mellon, who's been on the show, actually interviewed you. And after that happened, did you get contacted?
I had a lot of my old shipmates contact me because you got to remember our memories are 14 years later, and telling me, you were right on with that, but hey, you might you might want to say it this way because this is actually kind of how that works. Or, I've gotten a lot of confirmation, and I've gotten a lot of people have been able to confirm and deny a lot of stuff, like the USOs and stuff like that, because we've actually had to edit a lot of that stuff, because what I was told at the time was from a junior personnel, and apparently if he had known anything about it, it would have been something he did on his own. It wouldn't have been anything in an official capacity.
Oh, so it couldn't be collaborated, basically.
Exactly. So I completely redacted that, because it was, even though it was something that literally was told to me at the time, the senior personnel that told me about this was a sonar technician and one of the more higher ranking ones that I knew personally and trusted.
Hmm. You're talking about the object going into the actual ocean, right, Gary?
Us being able to track it at the time. If it was tracked, it was not by our ship. Our ship would, other than getting a ping, it was not going to be able to tell you bearing, speed, or anything on anything, because we did not have our sonar buoys or our tail in the water.
I see. I've wondered about that. I've wondered about the sonar. Robert, going back to the Facebook page and you contacting everyone, how did that pan out overall?
It worked out really well, because my main objective is I wanted to talk to everyone I could before they became, interactive with the UFO community and all that, because our memories change, and the more you hear other people say things, the more it can affect you.
That's right.
In fact, all of us are like that. Mm-hmm. But the two things that, after talking to Kevin, that I really wanted to verify, one was that 0.78 seconds, right? Because the speed calculations and accelerations on that you're talking about thousands of G-forces and speeds so fast that an object should have just burned up in the atmosphere.
Really?
So I wanted to verify that, and I wanted to verify Kevin telling me that the tapes had been erased when he went there the next
day. Funny story about that is, when he's telling his story about it, I'm laughing because I'm the one that erased it all.
right. Yeah, oh. Gary was the one that erased them. But so one of the first things I asked Gary, and I don't know if you remember this, Gary, when we talked, but I asked you if you knew Kevin and how well you knew him. And the reason I was asking that was because I wanted to know whether you guys have been communicating, right? Or am I getting a totally independent comment? And what you told me is you were aware of him on the ship, but it's not like you guys at that time. I think you're close friends now, but at that time, my understanding was you guys weren't close friends.
Yeah, the rank between us would have kept us from having, we weren't sitting down and having coffee with each other. But, casual conversation on the bridge and, inside CSC, stuff like that. But, and it was always, senior chief to petty officer.
Right. So that was good, because that way when I interviewed you, I had a truly second independent witness. And so when I asked you about how long it took, I always remember your answer. It's kind of burned into my head. And because I said, how long did it take? And you said, how long did it take you to generate that thought in your head?
Yeah. Sounds like something I'd say.
Yeah. And so that fits very well with Kevin's 0.78 seconds. My thoughts are about 0.72 seconds.
Just, on a good day, right?
Yeah. It's pretty quick. And then the other part, which you just mentioned, is I wanted to verify, why were the – did you have any information about the tapes being deleted? And, of course, like you said, you're the one who deleted them. And then you told me about the helicopter that landed and they requested –
Yep. Yeah, the physical data recording off of the Aegis system, that was taken. that was taken by the chain of command and then relinquished. And then anything else that wasn't on tape was just deleted.
Now, yeah. Is that, Gary, is that a standard procedure or was there something a little awry in that?
Well, with any type of incident or event, the only other time I've ever had to worry about data recording is when I think it was either a plane or a helicopter went down during our last deployment, and they needed all the tapes for that. And it was kind of similar to that situation, and but it wasn't as immediate. You know, there was literally somebody pretty quickly. It was in the same day that the intercept happened that we watched the video, and then of course all the data recording's gone.
Yeah. And I actually found a time in history where that occurred before. Not a UFO event, but the USS, and I guess Kevin, you were on this ship, I think at the time this occurred, the USS Vincennes, if I pronounce it right.
Talking about the Airbus incident?
Yeah. Where we shot down a Iranian.
Vincennes, it was.
Yeah, we don't like talking about that one.
Flight 655, Iranian Flight 655 in 1988. It was my first deployment. I had nothing to do with it. I was my first plane. I was a real junior. I think I was a third class petty officer. Right. And my watch station just happened to be right behind the captain. So I was like the proverbial fly on the wall for the whole thing.
As a result of that incident,
that's when the Navy really got serious about recording information,
right?
So that we could figure out what happened after the fact.
And in that case, a helicopter landed and took and removed the everything. It didn't disappear, right? Because Congress went through and investigative committees went through that information, but it was removed very quickly.
Yeah, it was all overt. It wasn't a covert operation or anything. Right. In fact, they actually flew out psychologists out to the ship because, you know, obviously there was quite a few people on the ship were having serious trouble accepting what we had just done. It was so horrible, almost unimaginable.
Wonder where those psychologists were when we were launching Tomahawks.
Interesting. Well, Robert, when you were actually – you know, going through the Facebook page, how many witnesses other than the ones that we know about did you speak with that, you know, did not want to come forward? Were there any that did not want to come forward?
Well, there was one other individual I interviewed, and if I remember his name right, this is off the top of my head, I believe it's Jason Turner.
Oh, yes, Jason. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I talked to Jason, and there were probably another 8 people on that Facebook site. But none of them were willing to discuss it. So,
and I've discussed this with over 33 individuals, and so I mean, who that came out, that's the only people so far.
Right.
I've gotten a lot of information from other people, but I still haven't been able to convince a lot of people to come out about it.
Now, were there any other eyewitnesses that you're aware of? Either one of you, Gary or Robert.
I'm aware that most of the people in the Aegis suites, all us Aegis techs, and you know, people that were privy of the more detailed information, I knew other people were going up to the bridge wing. I knew other people were sitting in combat. So, I mean, there's other people that were completely aware of this. And to some degree, some people are excited and they're really interested in seeing where this goes. And I think if this goes into a more positive culture, that we're going to get a lot more of these people. Yeah. But if it turns on us and, you know, we all start looking like idiots and nobody wants to feel that way. So they won't go for it.
Yeah. That's a very big fear of mine, actually, is that, you know, something will come out like something is disinformation and, you know, the New York Times article was bogus. Or something like that, we look like idiots. That's just a fear I have that something didn't play out right.
I don't think you have to worry about that.
I know.
No, the good news is this really did happen. The details are going to change as we get more people and we get more information. That's why, Nick, earlier you said, you know, am I open to any other ideas? Anytime. Come and discuss it.
Right. So, Robert, can you – you said you started looking into this in 2016, right? And
right.
And how did you hear about it? I wasn't hearing anything about this back then that I'm aware of, or little bits and pieces maybe.
A unknown source, which I can't, mention, told me about the case, and they just told me where to go to find the Marine. Remember the report from Lieutenant Colonel Kurth that showed up in a Navy blog. So they told me about that, and I went to that site and I read the Navy blog.
Mm-hmm.
And once I read the Navy blog, I knew that I could just tell. After you've done hundreds of cases, you can tell when you've got a real case and when you've got one that's not going anywhere. And I could tell that, this case had legs. And so the next thing that I started doing was sending out FOIA requests to the Navy. And I got constant denials of information, that they had no information. I got that denial from some Navy organizations that today are now saying, yes, there were these UAPs, right? But when I first sent it, it was, no, we don't. And so then I appealed one of my FOIAs. And when I appeal, I always copy my congressman, and I do a written letter rather than electronic. And that time I got back a response. And then the response was basically the Navy JAG officers asking some officers that had been on the USS Nimitz at the time. And they said, do you know anything about this? And this one lieutenant colonel said, oh, the Tic Tacs. Yeah, we know all about the Tic Tacs. And he went on and gave the names of five or six other officers. None of them have come forward who had seen the video on board the USS Nimitz. So I think that video was seen by, I would guess, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of servicemen.
I think just about everybody with a secret clearance and could get on that land was watching it.
Well, let's talk about the video. Wasn't there a video that we have not seen that was much clearer?
Well, the original video was much, much clearer. And contrary to any popular opinion, it was much longer than what you see.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a reason why it's limited the way it is. But
when I interviewed Lieutenant Commander Slate, he gave me the best reason. I mean, it was just logical as to why that video was longer. He said, when we go into if you go into a situation and you don't know what's going to happen, you don't wait until you're in the situation to turn on your FLIR. As he described it, its wheels are up, the FLIR's on, and that's on until you get back. So there's no reason why you would wait until you get into a situation to turn on the FLIR.
And then there was a meat and potatoes version of the of it that was emailed to officers that was much shorter.
What do you know about that in particular?
I don't know much.
Well, I can tell you that exact same grainy video that we all see now, the Tic Tac video, I got that in my email. I think must have been an MPEG video. I don't remember at this point. But when I saw this New York Times story come out, and I saw that same video that I'd seen all the years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I had just opened the kitchen down at the golf course. I was carrying out a plate of food because we didn't have any waiters yet, and I actually dropped the plate of food, man, because I was in total shock. I was like, oh my God, I don't believe this is happening, because I knew in that moment my life was going to change. There was no doubt in my mind, because I felt an overwhelming sense of duty to back up Commander Fravor, up the story, because I was there. This was really happening, and I witnessed it.
Wow. Gary, I want to go back to your theory, because Gary has kind of a theory. I want to say kind of a theory. He has a theory that this could be advanced technology of reverse engineered possible alien craft. Something along those lines. But Gary, just a couple of questions that had come to mind. And this does not have to do with this particular tic-tac of what people were seeing. This has to do with UFOs in general. there's some questions here. And the question that I'm asking you is your theory about the gravity propulsion or whatever it is that you termed it. What about things like when this object moved in 0.78 seconds or whatever it is from 28,000 feet down to whatever the ocean, near the ocean surface that quickly? Robert mentioned that it would, you know, an object would burn up. There's that question. Then there's also, why are there no sound barrier, you know, sound booms, whatever they used to call those.
Sonic booms are a result of displacement of air.
Right.
If you're not displacing the air and you're in a bubble of space-time, then you're not going to, A, burn up, B, cause any type of sonic booms whatsoever.
If you're visualizing this, would you think that the object would have some type of an aura or something around it? Or do you think it would just look like a regular object?
I think it probably could have ambient lighting that it turned on and off, just like we do in our own spacecraft. That's not out of the realm of possibility. Because you got to remember, what we do as a practical thing, like we put lights on our planes, we put lights on our cars. Why wouldn't they put some type of lighting system on their aircraft?
No, that's not really what I was talking about. Basically, I mean, okay, that if this had the capabilities you're talking about, wouldn't it kind of distort the areas around it? Or would it? Do you think that it would look like just an object?
I think it would probably just look like an object, because I don't think you could perceive the distortions.
I see.
Then again, I've never actually seen the technology, so I really don't know.
Yeah. Robert, what are your thoughts on the possibility that it's some type of reverse engineered technology or just secret technology?
Well, let's see. Just first a quick comment. When I interviewed Lieutenant Commander Slate, he did mention that when he saw the object, that there was around it something similar to what you see when you see hot pavement on a hot summer day.
Hmm.
And he's the only person that mentioned that, but he was pretty confident that there were like heat waves around the object. I guess reverse engineering, my background's in the semiconductor field, and we actually did reverse engineering. I worked at a company called Advanced Micro Devices. We reverse engineered Intel chips sometimes, and I'm sure they reverse engineered ours. It takes quite a while to reverse engineer something that you even know about. If you took a computer chip today and gave it to the best scientists of the year 1850, it would be impossible for them to reverse engineer it, because they would need an electron microscope to see the nanometer size metal lines, and the electron microscope had not even been invented. And of course, there would be no internet for them to see how the chip interacts with anything. So there's, and anything they did to the chip would probably destroy it. So their chances of reverse engineering it would be very, very low. Now, of course, today we're a much more modern society, or at least that's what we think we are. whether or not, you know, we could reverse engineer something that was hundreds of years more advanced than us, I would have my, you know, I think it would be extremely difficult.
Yeah, I would have my doubts on it. And it all depends on how long we've had it and, you know, exactly to what extent that we understood how any of it worked. And I mean, we could even just be utilizing parts off of their crafts, even though we don't know how they actually work.
Hmm.
Yeah, that we might be able to do, and this is all, I'm not saying that this is a, you know, that we have any alien craft, right? I'm not saying that at all. So I don't want any of your listeners to think I'm.
Now, of course, this whole line of theory is all based off the fact that we would have recovered a craft during Roswell.
Right.
And that's just this. It's a thought experiment I did from that point on, and how this would play out and how this would make sense. But I've got you know, 13 other ones too. So it's
So if you, you know, if you just take that assumption, and that's a big assumption, you can just say, okay, I'm going to set that aside and believe it for a moment. Well, what we might be able to reverse engineer might be, okay, what is the material that it's made out of? And then we would just be going, oh, okay, this is interesting. What can we do with this material? And then we would be coming up with our own ideas. We probably wouldn't know exactly what they were using the material for.
Well, it could have definitely inspired things like graphene, which is a big tech now.
Yeah, there's theories I've heard, you know, fiber optics and things like that, that, you know, is a possibility of, but I mean, who knows?
Well, I mean, just look at all the technologies you can just look at and say, you know, why would they do that? And then like later on saying, oh, well, whoa, go back to that other thing we were looking at, you know, 10 years ago, this is why they did it, you know, and then bam, you got something new.
But I know I've read sometimes people thought that that's where our microprocessors came from, but I was in that field. So I can tell you that, like, in that particular incident, started off with like 10 micron size transistors, you know, back in the 70s. And then we would shrink them. We'd get down to 9. Then we'd work real hard and we'd get down to 8. And we just kept going down. Of course, now we're at sub micron size transistors. But none of that was, that was all just hard work over many, many years.
Interesting. Well, I know. Where would you? I think you made a really good analogy, Robert. It would be like handing a caveman, you know, something of 19th century technology, or handing a cell phone to someone back in 1920. You know, try to reverse engineer that. You know.
Oh. Yeah, actually, I said 1850 because in 1920 they had the electron microscope, and they might have been able to make some progress back in 1920. 1850, probably not.
Yeah, well, it's all speculation, and
right, it's just a mental game.
Yeah, and I know, you know, you hear on TV, on news shows and stuff like that, when they're interviewing someone like David Fravor or Lou Elizondo or someone like that, they're trying to push him to say alien, you know. But, you know, you did hear David Fravor say, I think it was something not of this world. You know, and I think even if he's wrong, he's right, because, you know, we don't know of something like that that could be reproduced in this world.
Right. For me, the accelerations exhibited were just too high to be explained with anything we could do. I mean, if we have those type of capabilities, we would be on Mars in a week, not 6 to 7 months.
Right.
One note on these high accelerations and gravity. It really doesn't matter if you're in a gravity. Well, let me backtrack that a little bit. Not being in a gravitational field does not allow you to have high accelerations, right? Because when we put a rocket in space and there's no gravity around it, you can't have extreme accelerations. What would be required to have extreme accelerations like that, and would be for your inertial mass to approach zero. In other words, if I could take an F-18 and I could magically drive its mass to zero or close to zero, then I could accelerate it with a few photons of light, which are moving at the speed of light, and it would push that object at an extreme speed very rapidly. But it takes more than just not being in a gravitational field to do it.
Wow. This is kind of beyond my level of thinking.
Yeah, and that's actually why I moved. That very reason is why I moved more towards some of the newer thought processes on quantum entanglement and some of the ways that they're thinking that we could probably use it to move, especially over great distances and small distances.
Yeah, basically, quantum entanglement means it's a particle that can react. React no matter where it is, right? I mean, can you just give that in a nutshell how that works, Gary?
Just the basic theory is that, there's sets of particles that are disconnected over, short distances, vast distances, and basically that they are connected in some way. The details of it, just Google quantum entanglement. Yeah. The theory is that you could use it to open up a bridge from one point to another.
Yeah, I've thought of communication. You think of just the delay it will be like, for instance, if we were on Mars and we were, telecommunicating to Mars, it takes, I don't know how many minutes it would take, but, something like quantum entanglement for communication even would be instantaneous if they ever can figure out how to do something like that.
Right. If you use quantum entanglement to communicate, it would be instantaneous no matter where you were. I mean, in a nutshell, what they do is, let's just say you take a photon of light, right? And let's say it was a given wavelength of 1,000 angstroms. You run it through a crystal that splits that into two photons. Each are now, let's say, 2,000 angstroms in length. So they're different wavelengths, but they came from the same photon. Now you send that one photon off somewhere, and you keep the other photon, let's say, somehow bouncing around in a jar. The first photon hits a piece of black paper and gets absorbed. Mm-hmm. The photon in your jar disappears because he was just absorbed.
Wow.
So that's basically what happens. And everything that's been done today involves like maybe a dozen photons or less. No one that I'm aware of has done any large scale quantum entanglement, but theoretically nobody here has done that.
Robert, I have a quick question about the behavior of the entanglement with the photons. Let's say, as another example, what if the remote photon was actually split again? It created two new photons from that one. Would the local photon split too?
Actually, that's a good question, Kevin. I mean, I'm a chemist, not a physicist, but I might ask Kevin Newth that question.
You can ask Deep that question.
Yeah. If you resplit it again, will your other photon split into two?
If that's the case, you could create a telegraph, because the actual information could be encoded in the timing of the splits, where you're not transferring information. You're just observing it locally. Okay, it's split again.
Yeah, you can only do that probably so many times because you're basically...
There's still only so much energy. So, yeah. I mean, eventually you will... I mean, it just gets converted to something else, but it will eventually deplete.
Guys lost me back at... I don't even know where. we have people working on the phone system right now. There's some type of issue going on with it. There's an engineer working at the radio station trying to figure out what that is. So we're not taking calls as of right now, but if they get that repaired over there, then we'll take calls later on. Robert, since you're like the person who's like in ufology, I would say on this, you have looked at this a long, long time. I have... My thoughts is that this case, the Nimitz case in particular, to me has risen up to the level of one of the top UFO sightings that I'm aware of. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I agree with you because of the quality and the number of witnesses. I think it's one of the best cases that has ever come along. And you have to realize there's a lot more data that we don't even have, right?
Yeah.
The Navy has all that radar data, not only on the 2004 case, but the 2015 case. So
right,
you've got a lot of good detailed information that can be gone through. And I would hope and assume that they've had someone go through that data.
I would think so. I mean, you know, unless, you know, like Gary was saying earlier, that it's, you know, our own technology. One thing I do think is very curious that he mentioned is that, you know, the upper level officers kind of like said, oh, yeah, you know, that type of thing, did like it was no big deal. I mean, to me, that's very puzzling.
Well, see, the things that kind of bothered me about the whole event, like, because after Mr. Powell came out and he was talking with us about it, of course, it brings a lot of backup, and it just kind of rekindled this whole thing for me. So, I mean, I just been thinking about how everything could have worked out. You know, the feel of the time, I still don't understand why it took him so long to intercept and why it ended up taking a senior chief to say, hey, this is a good idea for them to actually do it. Because if he had never said anything, who knows if we would have done an intercept on him. You know, so, I mean, it's, to me, it just feels weird that we would have not done anything about it and for so long.
And also, another thing, Gary, why would the Navy be okay with the conversation if this was technology that is not supposed to be out there?
Well, I mean, like I said, you know, they're not fools. I mean, the people in the government, as foolish as they can be in a group, the individuals themselves are, you know, smarter than all of us combined. I mean, they got to be smart enough to realize that they just can't keep it under wraps forever. I mean, with everybody literally, like I said, with a 4K camera, video, everything in their damn pockets, walking around, eventually somebody's going to get information that can't be refuted. And I mean, so they just can't keep it under wraps forever.
Gary, did you actually, I know you handled like the radar data, stuff like that, but did you actually handle the videos as well?
Anything that would have been recorded on it. I think videos would have probably been on the computer systems, which wouldn't have been recorded on my data. Any of the data from CC would be plot point data and would be more statistical data and numbers. So unless you had a program to translate that into a picture, I mean, it was technically a 3D picture of everything that went on. But it wasn't like, you know, in, you know, Battlestar Galactica, where you can just look at this monitor and see a 3D picture of the battlefield. It was just all statistical data in a computer system. And then that puts tracks on our screens and lets us know what's going on.
Now, were you actually involved when the helicopter landed and they confiscated the data? Were you involved in that? I mean, did you see that happen personally?
I was in the hangar with the Crash and Smash people. I wasn't Crash and Smash. I was hanging out with them, and that's where I hung out anytime the flights came in, because it was easier than being where I wanted to be. But and you know, I saw the helicopter land, saw people get off, plainclothes people, and there was no Air Force insignias or anything like that. They didn't look any particular way. No Men in Black. I'll go with them that it was not a Men in Black, but I don't, it was, the way that they dressed is nondescript enough where I really don't particularly remember exactly how they were dressed.
Right.
So
a lot of years ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just remember they got off the helicopter and less than 20 minutes later, I'm asked to report and grab all my tapes and any tapes that aren't used. Even the blank tapes that we had to be erased, because when we do the erasing, it leaves a timestamp so that they know for certain that it was erased and there was never any data on them.
Wow. Did you think that was really bizarre at the time?
No. I'm smart enough to know that, you know, I mean, if I was the government, this is what I would do.
Wow. Robert, when you were and Kevin, I want to get you back on in a minute here, because I want to talk to you about your book and all that. But Robert, when you were researching this, how did everything unfold? You know, I mean, what type of information did you find out? Like, you were the, you know, that you were able to, and this was with a group too, right?
Yes. There were other individuals. For example, in order to interview Lieutenant Commander Slate, we have a former Navy captain who's in SCU, SCU being the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, the group that I'm in.
Right.
So we used the Navy captain to first approach Lieutenant Commander Slate. So he interviewed him first. And it just works better that way, right? One Navy guy talking to another Navy guy, where he probably wouldn't have talked to me, because as probably Kevin and Gary can tell you, the pilots are a little bit different breed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are.
Yeah, I knew one, and yeah, he had kind of an ego issue.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, well, you know, I mean, you shouldn't characterize a whole group, right? But if you've seen the movie Top Gun, that's not too far off.
Well, I mean, they're feeding these guys egos all the way along, because I mean, not many people can fly a jet. Yeah. I mean,
right. And these guys are sharp. I mean, they are very sharp.
They have both,
both he and Fravor are very matter of fact, and they're very good witnesses.
Sure.
But once the gentleman in our group talked to Commander Slate, then, you know, he told him, would you talk to Robert, blah, blah, blah. And so then when I called him, it was fine. However, we only had the captain's interview with Lieutenant Commander Slate and my interview, because after that, I think the way the media handles the entire issue is so, you know how bad it is, Martin. It's just so bad that he would not talk anymore to anyone. So yeah, that was it for him.
They want to reduce everything to a soundbite, or if they can't, if they can't monopolize on it, or they can't scare somebody with it, they just don't want to deal with it.
It's and they can't put little green or gray aliens next to you.
Yeah.
It's just not exciting.
Well, I've noticed a change, Robert, since that article came out, in the New York Times, since late 2017. I've noticed a change on the news media of this being taken more seriously and not being made fun of. It seems like there's a lot of people in the mainstream media that actually are interested and are doing a pretty good reporting these days.
Yes, I will agree that has improved some, but the question will that be a lasting improvement?
Right.
And I actually think that probably depends on the Navy and how they go forth with it. Because if you'll notice, the Air Force has continued with their normal stance. When the large media organizations asked the Air Force for their comment, it was no comment. We don't deal with, dealing with that.
It's always been hard to get the chair force to get up.
I wonder why, the Navy is, you would just think that they would kind of fall in line.
Well, you know, that's the interesting part. And I don't I'm not sure what's going on here, because the Navy has always been very difficult to get information out from them. When you go back historically, I'm talking about, historically, and for them to kind of suddenly change their tune makes me, and I don't think it's like a PR, a public affairs officer who misspoke, because he's spoken this way several times and he hasn't been corrected. So this appears to be intentional. And the only, my only theory on it is that maybe they want a bigger slice of the defense budget, and they're going to use this as an argument as to why they need a bigger part of the slice of the pie. It's the only thing I can think of.
Mm. Wow. Interesting. The phone is not working, as I mentioned, and I do have a way to take calls on Skype, but I'm just afraid.
I got a question.
Go ahead.
I got a question for Robert. And the question comes from a super duper guy by the name of Dave Altman.
Oh, yes.
And it's about Contact in the Desert coming up in May, Robert. And we were wondering if you would consider going there. Going to Contact in the Desert with us. Gary is here. I'll be there.
How about we talk about talking to him when we're not blasting him on air?
That's
talk about it offline.
Don't you guys understand that's all Dave Altman's
I did it as a favor for Dave. He wanted me to ask him on the air. So there.
Yeah,
there
he wanted. And Dave. He said. Dave don't has expect his ways. Yeah. Yeah. So Kevin, since you just piped up, and again we can't take calls, but I'm gonna try to look into the chat room to see if there's some questions that come up in there that I can answer.
And while you're doing that, I'll talk a little bit about my book.
Yeah, you go right ahead. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, when I retired in 2008, this whole thing really gravely concerned me. I actually started having nightmares over it because I was concerned for safety of flight, number one. And I was also thinking, what if the same damn thing happened overseas when I really did have missiles and there really was hostilities? It, just a simple overreaction could create World War III. I mean, something really bad could happen. But I tried to tell people, I tried to talk to people, and back then no one really believed you, I guess. Even my own family kind of like looked at me weird. So what I did is I wrote a short story. It's called The Seer, and it's a fictionalized account of what happened that day on the Nimitz and on the Princeton. And I wrote a couple other short stories to go with it, and I actually published it in the Library of Congress just in case the story ever became public, that my book would provide some sort of contemporaneous evidence that this really did in fact happen. And that's exactly what happened. My book is now considered evidence. A gentleman, another super duper guy by the name of Alejandro Rojas, on his own dime, found my book and he published it. And that book that I never had any intention of ever selling or doing anything other than just being a piece of evidence is now for sale on Amazon. It's called Sailor's Anthology, and it doesn't cost a whole lot of money. But if I could plug my book's on Sailor's Anthology. The proceeds from the sales, in part, is going to fund our expedition off the coast of Southern California. And so that's my plug for the book.
All right, great. I have a question in chat, and it's to both Kevin and Gary. Did either one of you happen to catch the interview with David Fravor on Joe Rogan?
I didn't listen to it.
Yeah, I watched the whole thing. I listened to the whole thing.
Oh, you did? And, I saw today a posting on I have not listened to it yet, but I saw a posting on Facebook today from Mick West, who's Metabunk. He's, likes to debunk things. And he was taking on a part of that where I guess David Fravor talks about faking a UFO when he was camping, as a joke. So I confronted Mick. I said, Mick, are you trying to say that David has no credibility? What's going on? And, at the end, Mick said, no, there's definitely a difference between being a witness and lying or not lying to a bunch of people and doing a joke. So I was glad to hear that part of it. What did you think overall, Gary? Gary? Do you hear me, Gary?
Yeah, I can hear you. Sorry, I had to. Yeah. I was keyed over to another window for a second. I thought he did a pretty good job on it. I still have some point of contentions just on certain aspects of his personality, but I've come out on Facebook and Twitter, and I just want to make sure everybody understands that no matter what I think of his personality, no matter what he says about this UFO, I am 100% behind, and I believe anything he says about the flight. I have the utmost confidence in everything that he says about the story.
And I do too, Gary. Commander Fravor is one of the finest damn pilots the Navy's ever produced. In impeccable character. He just has certain different points of view on some of this than we do. And I think that's to be understood. I mean, we were on the ship. He was in his aircraft. And
you got to understand, his whole point of view for this entire event is from the point that he got tasked with this on. Uh-huh. We were dealing with this for weeks prior to.
And then after.
Yeah.
Well, I got to say something about Kevin right now. And that is, Kevin, for you to say such a nice thing about David after he kind of hammered you at one of the conferences, but I don't think he was really understood who you were or whatever at the time.
I forgive him. I understand. I really do. And I've got nothing but respect for the man.
Oh, that's good. That just shows your level of integrity as far as I'm concerned. Here's a question from Steven in the chat room. If they were witnessing other world level technology, why did they leave the scene there where there have been numerous sightings? I think I kind of addressed that, but I don't know. He probably didn't listen to the first part of the show.
No, the only reason we left is because we were part of the U.S. Navy and we go exactly where they tell us to go.
Yeah, of course. But you know, back to the question that I had about that. I mean, if they really were witnessing some, you know, bizarre technology that was not ours, it seems to me that they would do some more investigating myself. That's what I would think. So, Robert, you're still on, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So, Robert, you're fading away. It's getting dark in your room there.
Oh, we can still see you.
You're very grainy, but anyway, what do you think? You know, why they didn't stick around and really investigate? I mean, if this was technology that they were unaware of, wouldn't it just make sense for them to really try to explore to see what the heck these things were and, you know, really?
Well, a couple of things. One, that wasn't, you know, that wasn't the Carrier Strike Group's mission. So yeah,
that's true.
You know, and then the second is there's a certain psychological, sociological aspect to the whole UFO phenomenon, right? There's such stigma to it, right? I think it's best characterized by, I was talking to a guy, he happened to be in the Navy also, and I asked him if he logged in the incident. They saw a disc right over their ship. Did you log that incident into the deck log so I could go FOIA it, right? And he said, well, I asked the captain if I should put this, you know, in our logbook. And his reply was, no, I want to make admiral someday.
Hmm.
Right? So I don't think it's so much that anyone's trying to hide something as it is. It's almost like if you had a ghost that showed up on board, right? No one's going to put that in a logbook. I don't think it's so much that the military tries to hide things, is it's just something nobody wants to deal with, both psychologically and socially.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think a lot of incidences go untold and you don't hear about forever. It has a lot to do with what he's saying. And, I mean, there's a lot that goes on a ship that doesn't get logged that probably should. I mean, you know, everything from sexual harassment to violence to, you know, like you said, you know, ghosts, UAV, unmanned aircraft. So there's a lot that goes undocumented in the military.
Wow. Someone wanted me to ask you in the chat room if the jamming of the radar that Fravor, I guess, talks about, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my personal thoughts is that he's been flying jets for probably longer than I was alive at the time. So if he says that he was being jammed, I absolutely believe him.
I do too. Although I have to say we never received any jamming on the ship.
And you would? You had sensitive?
I would have known about that. It was part of the identification process.
How does that show up? Is it like a warning or something?
There's a console. It's the EW operator. He would get the information on his console, basically a direction and a strength, and the type of jamming, you know, what type of signal it is. And oh, by the way, active jamming is considered a hostile act.
Oh,
it's according to the rules of engagement. So,
okay. So according to the rules,
that was not when during the time, it wasn't my situational awareness that there was any jamming. But yeah. I do have to believe what Commander Fravor has said about it. He would know.
For clarification on that, I believe Commander Fravor was talking about the video. My understanding is neither he nor Lieutenant Commander Slate felt that they were jammed at the time they were having the engagement. The jamming, I believe, is based on his interpretation of what he saw in the video. And I agree with Gary and Kevin. He says there was jamming on that video. I believe him.
Yeah, I don't have, you know, there's nothing else I can do but believe him.
Well, that kind of it shows, you know, the different phases of technology. You know, that I wouldn't think that if this was our own technology and we were experimenting with it, I would think that would be something that normally wouldn't be thought of as far as equipment. But, you know, what do I know? Any thoughts on that? Do you think that I'll ask you, Gary, if there that was reverse technology, do you think that would be part of it?
I think if it was that high level where it would only be the highest of people that knew about it, then it would be a situation where they would have already had everything set up. They would have already known where the battle group was going to be. They would have already had a set plan for what they wanted to do and contingency plans for anything that happened. And then they come out right after the incident because they know it happened. They collect all the data. They go analyze how well they did.
And this is with the thoughts that no one that witnesses would ever talk about it, right?
Well, I don't think they were really worried about it. I mean, they really did not seem worried about it whatsoever, which is another. Yeah, that's something that's always kind of boggled my mind, which is kind of lending me more to believe our tech than, you know, alien tech.
Why do you suppose some people were asked to sign an NDA, non-disclosure agreement, and some were not?
Well, because the one set of people that I know that had to sign the NDA, they got a really, really close look at these objects, a physically close look, where even the jets, you know, they were still half mile away from them as they were chasing them. So even though they got a good look at them and they know what they were, their shape, you know, even the Fravor's description is from a distance. The people in the Hawkeye, I mean, they're getting ridiculous amounts of data off of this thing. So they probably know something that all of us don't.
Right. Wow. You know what? I can't believe this. We're out of time already. I'm looking up and it's like, oh my, I have to end the show. So I want to thank you all very much. It's been a real pleasure. Robert, thank you for joining us in the last hour. Kevin, thanks so much. It's always great to speak with you. And Gary.
Can I give one more quick shout out?
Yes, go right ahead.
For some people new and following this story, there is a video on YouTube. It's called The Nimitz Encounters. And it's got 3.5 million views or some crazy number like that. And Dave Beatty is on his own dime. He's the one that created it. And for anyone interested in getting some background on this, go to YouTube and look and search for the Nimitz Encounters.
Okay. All right. We're out of time. Goodbye, everyone. Good night.
Goodbye.
All right. All right, everyone. Thanks so much. And we will be back next week again with Jacques Vallée. He'll be joining us. And also Alan Stivelman will be joining us as well with Jacques Vallée. And thank you, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.
Yeah, thank you, guys. I'm going to punch off here.
Night, Kevin.
All right.
Good night, Gary.
Bye, Gary. Bye, Kevin. Bye, Martin.